Conrad and Turnbuckle finally reached the hotel long after midnight. They had spent a couple of hours at police headquarters, being questioned separately and together by several different detectives on the San Francisco force. The detectives were suspicious, and Conrad knew they didn't fully believe Turnbuckle's story about how the attack must have been an attempted robbery. On the other hand, the carriage had been an expensive one before it was wrecked. Turnbuckle was a well-to-do attorney, and Conrad was a highly successful businessman. It was possible they had been tempting targets for a gang of thieves. Conrad knew it wasn't actually what had happened, of course, but he didn't admit that to the police. He had sensed all along that bringing the authorities in on his search for his missing children would be a mistake. To Pamela's warped mind, the whole thing had been a game, and instinct told him if he didn't play by her rules, he would regret it. The police were taking the incident seriously. 9 men were dead. The 6 bodyguards Turnbuckle had hired, and 2 strangers, who must have been members of the gang, and the driver. If the detectives knew the names of those men and who they associated with, they weren't sharing that information with Conrad and Turnbuckle. When the two of them were told they were free to go at last, Turnbuckle accompanied Conrad to the hotel. Conrad's bags, which had been brought separately to the hotel, had arrived safely. When they reached Conrad's suite, they found a bottle of brandy waiting for them, ordered earlier by Turnbuckle. Conrad poured drinks.
I want you to see to it that the families of the bodyguards who were killed tonight are taken care of. I'll pay for all the funeral expenses, and the family shouldn't be hurting for money for a while either.
I'll make sure of it. I would have anyway, even if you hadn't said anything. They were working for me on your behalf.
Exactly. Do you have any sources of information inside the police department?
Perhaps.
Maybe you can find out the identities of those gunmen who were killed. Knowing who they were and where they spent their time might lead us to whoever hired them.
The same thought crossed my mind. I'll have our investigators look into that, as well as continuing the search for the Golden Gate and DL.
All right. If I think of anything else, I'll be in touch.
And if we find out anything, I'll let you know immediately.
Claudius, I'm sorry my troubles have put you in danger again.
Think nothing of it. Since we've started representing the interests of you and your father, there's been more excitement in my life than ever before.
Not necessarily the sort of excitement you might want, though.
Speaking of your father, have you thought about getting in touch with him to see if he could help you with your search?
You know where Frank is?
Well, not exactly. I could probably locate him, though, if I set out to do so. The last I heard, he was in Alaska.
Alaska? That sounds like Frank. Always wandering.
Well, they don't call him the Drifter for nothing. Well, what about it? Do you want me to try to find him?
No. This is my problem, not Frank's.
He's always been glad to help before. And those children are his grandson and granddaughter, after all.
No.
Very well. It's up to you, certainly. I should be going and let you get some rest. I'm glad we both survived the night.
Conrad nodded. Surviving was generally a good thing, although there had been a time when he wished more than anything in the world that he had died along with Rebel, so that he wouldn't have to live without her. Once Turnbuckle was gone, Conrad stripped off the clothes that stunk of stale beer and tossed them on the floor. The hotel staff could clean them or burn them or whatever they wanted to do. He washed up, then fell onto the soft, luxurious 4-poster bed in the elaborately decorated bedroom. Despite his weariness, sleep didn't come easily to him. He thought about everything that had happened, and something occurred to him. He got up and padded over to the clothes he had discarded. From a pocket in the trousers, he took the little object he had picked up from the street next to the beer wagon. It was round, about the size and shape of a silver dollar, but it was lighter because it wasn't made from metal, but rather carved from what appeared to be ivory. The thing reminded Conrad of a poker chip, but it was bigger than most poker chips he'd seen, and it had a picture carved in relief on it. It might be an identification token, he decided as he turned it to get a better look in the light from the gas lamp he had turned on. Something a man might flash to gain entrance to a place, or to identify himself to others who might not know him otherwise. He realized almost instantly the scene depicted on the item was a familiar one. 2 points of land extended toward each other, with a wide stretch of water between them. Conrad had been to that place on numerous occasions, and he had ridden a ferry from one side of that strait to the other. His heart began to beat faster as he took in the implication of what he held in his hand. He was looking at a representation of the Golden Gate. Turnbuckle arrived at the hotel the next morning while Conrad was having breakfast, which a waiter had delivered and served in the sitting room of his suite. The lawyer looked tired, which was not surprising, considering his age and the fact that he had gotten only a few hours' sleep. He had news to report. He took the cup of coffee Conrad offered him.
I've been in touch with one of those sources inside the police department you mentioned. One of those would-be assassins killed last night was named Floyd Hambrick. He was a known criminal suspected of a number of killings along the Barbary Coast. His grandfather was Sidney Duck.
Conrad raised his eyebrows to indicate he didn't understand the reference.
That was a gang of Australian criminals who dominated the San Francisco underworld back in the 50s, in the days after the gold rush. A lot of them were hanged by the Committee of Vigilance, but some survived, and even married, and had children and grandchildren. In Hambrick's case, evidently, the proverbial apple didn't fall far from the proverbial tree.
Have the police been able to tie this fella Hambrick in with anybody else?
Not so far. I suspect it may not be a very productive lead. Hambrick, and no doubt the other two men, were simply hired assassins, the sort who would kill anyone if the price was right.
Conrad nodded. It wouldn't be the first time such men had come after him since he'd started his search for the twins. Someone was always masterminding those efforts, though. Someone who had been paid off directly by Pamela while she was still alive. He was confident that would turn out to be the case. That mastermind might finally be able to tell him where his children were. He picked up the ivory token from the table next to the fine china holding the remains of his breakfast and tossed it to Turnbuckle.
Have you ever seen anything like that before?
The lawyer studied the token, turning it over in his fingers and running a fingertip over its carved surface.
That looks like the Golden Gate.
I'm convinced it is.
Turnbuckle handed the token back to him.
But no, I've never seen one like it before. At least not that I recall. Where did you get it?
It was lying in the street next to the wagon carrying all those beer barrels. I can't prove the man who drove the wagon and cut the barrels loose dropped it, but he might have.
I'd say it's even likely. Should I take it now and show it to some of our investigators?
No, I'm going to hang on to it. But you can describe it to them and see if they remember ever seeing anything like it.
Fine, I'll do that. In the meantime, what are your plans?
You told me to rest and relax, remember? That's what I intend to do.
Turnbuckle looked a little like he had a hard time believing that, but didn't say anything. He finished his coffee and left. A short time later, dressed in a brown tweed suit, Conrad opened the door of the suite and looked out into the hall. A large man wearing a derby and sporting a red handlebar mustache sat a few feet away in an armchair he had pulled up from somewhere. The man was reading a newspaper, but he looked over and gave Conrad a polite nod.
I suppose Claudius stationed you there.
The boss says you ain't to be disturbed, Mr. Brownin. It's my job to see that things stay that way.
What's your name?
Dugan, sir.
Well, Mr. Dugan, you're supposed to prevent anyone from getting into this suite. Are you also supposed to prevent me from leaving?
Dugan set his paper down in his lap, took off his hat, and scratched a bald, somewhat bullet-shaped head.
He didn't say nothing about that.
Well, I'm surprised.
Well, just that if you go anywheres, I'm to go with you and make sure nothing happens to you.
Oh. Do you have a family, Mr. Dugan?
Aye, sir. A fine wife and four red-headed little ones.
Did Mr. Turnbuckle inform you that the last men he hired to watch over me all wound up dead?
He told me. That don't matter. I'm being paid to do a job, and I figure on doing it.
That's an admirable attitude. And I assure you, if anything happens to you, I'll see to it that your family is taken care of financially. Or if I can't, Mr. Turnbuckle will.
That's a reassurance indeed, sir. But I don't plan on winding up dead.
Let's hope for the sake of those four red-headed little ones that you're right.
Conrad closed the door. Dugan was going to make things a little more difficult, because he was determined no one else was going to lose their life because of him. A little more difficult, yes. But not impossible. Conrad stayed close to his hotel room all day, leaving it only to eat lunch in the palace's sumptuous American dining room. Dugan trailed him and took a table in an unobtrusive corner where he could keep an eye on Conrad. It was likely Dugan could not afford to eat there, and Conrad assumed Turnbuckle had instructed the hotel to put the bodyguard's meal on his tab. Conrad chose to have supper in the suite, as he had breakfast. Dugan had gone off duty and been replaced by a short, thick individual who introduced himself as Morelli. The new bodyguard followed the waiter into the suite.
Could be one of them assassins in disguise.
The waiter, who by his accent was Russian, took offense at that, and Conrad chewed them both out and told them to take their squabble outside. He ate supper and waited for full darkness to settle over the city by the bay. When it had, he took off his tweed suit, his cravat, and his white shirt. In their place, he pulled on a homespun shirt and a rough brown coat and trousers of the sort working men wore. While he was downstairs for lunch, he had stopped at the concierge's desk and made arrangements to have the clothes bought and delivered to his suite that afternoon, along with a stevedore's cap. He tugged the cap down over his fair hair and tucked the Colt behind his belt at the small of his back, where the coat would conceal it. The palace was as modern and up-to-date as it could be, but it didn't yet have fire escapes outside the windows, the way some hotels back east did. However, it did have decorative ledges along the exterior walls. Conrad slid open the window in his bedroom and stepped out onto the ledge. It was only about 6 inches wide. Facing the brick wall, he slid his feet along the ledge toward the corner of the building. His fingers went into the cracks between the bricks and gripped tightly to take some of the strain off his toes. His suite was on the fifth floor, so there was a lot of empty air underneath him, with hard, unforgiving pavement waiting at the end of any unlucky fall. There was also a drain spout at the corner, connected to the rain gutters around the roof of the building. That was his destination. After a few nerve-wracking minutes, he reached it. Keeping his feet on the ledge and one hand holding the wall, Conrad pulled on the spout to test its strength. Satisfied it would hold him, he moved both hands onto it and got a good grip. Supporting himself with the drain spout, he began walking down the side of the building. He knew it was a crazy thing to do, but he couldn't carry out the sort of investigation he wanted to if he had one or more of Turnbuckle's hired bodyguards watching him all the time. The trail led into the seamy district known as the Barbary Coast, and no one there was going to talk to the police. Those bodyguards looked like policemen, and some of them probably had been on the force before going to work for Turnbuckle. Conrad had to do it alone. It was his best chance to find out what he wanted to know, so he had to run the risk of climbing out of a hotel window and down a drain spout. His boots touched the floor of the alley next to the hotel. Having spent time in San Francisco, he knew how to get to the Barbary Coast. Because someone who knew him might see him and recognize him, he didn't follow the alley to the front of the hotel. He went to the rear, crossed the street quickly with his cap pulled down over his face, and found another alley that took him in the right direction. He smiled faintly, confident he had gotten out of the palace without Morelli or anyone else knowing he was gone. Sliding a hand in his pocket, he touched the ivory token he had brought with him. With any luck, before the night was over, he would know what it meant, and he would be one step closer to finding his children. Because he was preoccupied, as well as because he didn't have eyes in the back of his head, Conrad didn't see the hulking, shadowy figure that appeared at the mouth of the alley beside the hotel. He didn't realize he was being watched, didn't feel the dark, almond-shaped eyes tracking his every move as he crossed the street and entered the other alley. The figure was clad all in black and was next to invisible in the shadows. After a moment, the follower emerged from the alley and crossed the street as well. Moving so swiftly and silently despite its size, anyone watching might have taken it for a trick of the eyes, not something real and substantial. The figure entered the other alley, and the darkness swallowed it completely again, as if it had never been there. The area known as the Barbary Coast had grown up during the turbulent days following the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill, when Argonauts by the hundreds of thousands poured into San Francisco and used it as a jumping-off point in their quest for riches. Some of them decided to stay instead of heading for the gold fields. Some came back when they abandoned their dreams of finding a fortune, and many of those who were lucky enough to strike it rich returned to San Francisco intent on spending some of their newfound wealth. Naturally, there were plenty of tinhorns, whores, and bartenders willing to take that money from them. Gambling dens sprung up around the old Spanish plaza known as Portsmouth Square. Houses of prostitution spread along the waterfront. A man could get a drink in any of them, or in scores of other saloons, taverns, and dives. The atmosphere in those places ranged from high-toned and luxurious to downright squalid, and sometimes you could find examples of both in the same block along Clay, Kearny, Pacific, and Grant Streets. The boundaries of the rather nebulous area people called the Barbary Coast drifted here and there with time, and according to the vigilance of the local law enforcement agencies, but the core of its existence remained the same, the twin titans of lust and greed. They made up the foundation upon which the Barbary Coast was built. That was where Conrad was headed. A damp chill hung in the air along the bay, and tendrils of fog crept up from the water and curled through the streets. The only time Conrad had visited the Barbary Coast was when he was a much younger man, still in college. He and some of his wealthy classmates from back east were in San Francisco on a lark, and naturally they wanted to see the lurid denizens of the notorious area and sow some wild oats. In those days, Conrad had been as arrogant and obnoxious as his companions, so he had gone along willingly on the expedition. They had caroused and whored all night, and they had been extremely lucky they hadn't wound up shanghaied, bleeding and robbed in some alley, or wasted away from some pustulant disease. He had heard it said that God looks after drunkards and fools, and he and his friends had fit into both categories. Now, of course, things were totally different. Time and tragedy had humbled him, stripped away most of the arrogance and pretense. But he remembered how to get to the Barbary Coast, and a short time after slipping out of the Palace Hotel, he entered a saloon called the Bella Grande, which didn't live up to its name at all. Conrad kept his eyes down and moved in a somewhat furtive manner, but in reality, he was keenly studying everything around him. He made his way across the crowded, smoky room to the bar and slid a dime under the hardwood.
A schooner of beer.
The bartender tapped the bar next to the dime.
I'll need another one of those, and a nickel besides.
2 bits for a schooner of beer? What is this place, the damn palace?
It's the going rate, friend. You must have been at sea a long time if you didn't know that.
Conrad shrugged, picked up the dime, and pawed around in the handful of coins he pulled from his pocket. The ivory golden gate token was among them. The bartender couldn't help but see it, but he didn't react in any way as far as Conrad could tell. The man scooped up the 25-cent coin Conrad had dropped on the bar and drew the beer from a big keg. He used a paddle to cut off the head and slid the big glass in front of Conrad.
Seen Floyd around tonight?
Floyd who?
Hambrick. Floyd Hambrick.
Don't believe I know the gent.
Sure you do. He said he always drinks here.
Well, maybe he does, but I don't know him by name, mister. What's he look like?
Never mind. I'll just have a look around.
Yeah, you do that.
Conrad picked up his beer and moved off into the crowd. He circulated for a few minutes, then set the schooner on an empty table and slipped out a side door. He wanted to keep a clear head, so he couldn't keep guzzling down suds every place he went. One of the saloon's customers would snatch up the schooner and polish off the beer, probably by the time Conrad reached the street. Over the next hour, the scene in the Bella Grande was repeated, with minor variations, in half a dozen other saloons. If anybody knew Floyd Hambrick, they weren't admitting it. Nor did anyone react when Conrad flashed the ivory token. He was in a place called Spanish Charlie's when he got his first break. The bartender, who wasn't Spanish at all, but rather a fat blonde Dutchman, had professed never to have heard of Floyd Hambrick, and he didn't blink at the ivory token. Conrad still had it lying in the palm of his hand, along with some coins, when one of the women who worked in the place sidled up beside him.
Ooh, you've been to the Golden Gate.
Conrad looked over at her and revised his original opinion. Despite the painted face and the low-cut dress that revealed her breasts to the upper curve of her brown nipples, she wasn't a woman, but rather a girl, no more than 15 or 16 years old. He swallowed his disgust that a girl so young would be working in a place like that and put a leer on his face. It was probably what the girl was used to. He hadn't missed what she'd said.
Golden Gate, eh?
See.
The girl, at least, was Spanish, or Mexican more likely, maybe a descendant of one of the proud Californio families that had settled the area long before any gold-seeking Americans arrived.
The nicest place down here, or so I've heard. I've never been there. It's not a place for one such as I.
Don't say something like that, darling. You're worthy of going anywhere you want to go.
The bartender rested a hand with fingers like sausages on the hardwood.
Where she really like to go is upstairs with you, mein Herr. Ain't that right, Carmen?
The girl batted her dark eyelashes at Conrad.
See, yes.
With a noticeable lack of enthusiasm, she pushed her breasts against Conrad's arm and cocked a hip so it pressed against his, though without any real urgency.
She would cost you only $1, mein Herr.
Conrad pretended to think about it. Carmen, the bartender had called her, was the first person he'd encountered who admitted knowing anything about the carved ivory token. He'd wanted to talk more with her, and some privacy would probably make the conversation more productive. With pretended reluctance, he slid a silver dollar across the bar. The coin disappeared into the Dutchman's fat fingers.
She better be worth it.
Oh, she will. She will. Won't you come?
Oh, you'll never forget me, senor.
The girl linked her arm with his.
Come with me.
She led him toward a staircase on the other side of the room. Conrad looked up at the second floor and saw a large number of rooms arranged along a balcony. They were rooms, only in the strictest sense of the word. Thin wooden partitions, a foot short of reaching the ceiling, separated them, and curtains closed off the front. The room where Carmen was taking him wouldn't provide much privacy, but it would be better than nothing. She kept bumping her hip against him, seemingly out of habit, as they went upstairs. When they reached the balcony, she led him to the nearest room where the curtain was pushed back, but he steered her toward one farther along that had an empty room on each side.
You're going to be yelling in pleasure. We don't want to disturb anybody else.
Oh, senor, I'm sure I will be.
She didn't argue as Conrad took her into the room and jerked the curtain closed. As he turned toward her, she had already reached down and grasped the hem of her dress to pull it over her head.
Wait a minute. Just hold on.
You do not want me to take off my dress?
Not just yet. Why don't you sit down?
She shrugged and sank onto the narrow bed. It was a little more than a cot, and it was the only piece of furniture in the room other than a small, rickety-looking table. The light came from gas fixtures hung over the balcony. Their glow spilled over the short partitions, making the room a little dim, but Conrad had no trouble seeing the puzzled expression on Carmen's painted face as she looked up at him.
What is it you wish me to do?
I thought we'd talk for a few minutes first. I'd like to get to know a girl before I...
Then you are an unusual man. Most men don't want to know anything about me.
I'm not like most men. You should know that because I have that token from the Golden Gate, right?
Oh, yes. Only the best people go there. Well, the best people for this part of town, anyway. I have heard there are crystal chandeliers. Is this true?
I never paid that much attention to the lights.
And a long bar made of the finest mahogany. Oh, I would love to see it.
I'm sure you will one of these days. Maybe I'll take you. How'd you like to go sporting in there on my arm?
Oh, senor, that would be wonderful.
She started to push her dress off her shoulders, obviously figuring she would disrobe in the other direction since he'd stopped her from pulling the garment over her head.
Hold on, hold on. It's been a long time since I've been there. The Golden Gate's on Kearney Street, right?
No, on Grant, near where the Chinese live.
Oh, yeah, that's right. On Grant Street. I told you, it's been a long time.
Carmen reached for her dress again.
Please, senor, if we do not do what we came up here for, I will get in trouble.
I never said we weren't going to.
But I'm only allowed so much time with each customer.
Conrad took the token from his pocket and held it up.
You have to show one of these before they let you into the place, right?
Into the private rooms on the second floor, yes. Or so I've heard. But you would know that if you had been there.
I just wasn't sure what the procedure was now, since I've been gone for a while.
Did you bring me up here because you like me, senor, or because you are some sort of spy?
Spy? That's crazy. I just...
Without warning, she darted past him and jerked aside the curtain that closed off the room.
Dutchie! Dutchie!
Conrad hurried after her. She was at the landing at the top of the stairs. The fat bartender had come out from behind the bar and was waiting at the bottom of the stairs with an angry expression on his florid face.
What in blazes is going on up there?
Carmen ran down the stairs.
He asked too many questions, Dutchie. I think he's a spy for one of your competitors or a policeman.
I'm not either of those things.
Conrad reached the top of the staircase.
I was just talking to the girl.
Men who come here aren't interested in talking. I don't know what you're up to, mister, but I don't like it. Hans Ulrich!
Two men emerged from the shadows, one at each end of the balcony. The huge, blonde bruisers stalked toward Conrad, each with scarred fists and broken noses of men who had dealt out and received plenty of violence in their lives.
Take him! I show you what we do with spies, mein Herr.
Hans and Ulrich were big, but they were slow.
Yeah!
Conrad avoided their lumbering rush by bounding down the stairs toward Dutchie and Carmen.
Help! Stop him! Help!
Several burly customers sprang to Dutchie's aid. As Conrad reached the bottom of the staircase, a man pushed Dutchie aside and swung a mallet-like fist at Conrad's head. Conrad ducked the punch and hooked a hard right into the man's midsection. The man doubled over and staggered backward. Unfortunately, that delay was long enough for one of Dutchie's bouncers to leap down the stairs and slam into Conrad from behind. He wrapped his arms around Conrad and lifted him off his feet. They crashed onto a table that splintered under their weight. Conrad landed amidst the debris with his attacker on top of him.
Hold him, Yorick!
Ulrich's arms tightened around Conrad, preventing him from drawing in any air to replace what he had lost. Almost instantly, Conrad's head began to spin, and a red haze drifted over his eyes. Suddenly, the vice-like grip around his chest and the great weight on his back was released. He rolled over and laid on his chest. His blurry eyesight cleared after a moment, and he saw a large black-clad shape flashing back and forth. He pushed himself to a sitting position and got a better look at what was going on. His rescuer was a tall, broad-shouldered man who kept Dutchie, the bouncers, and the patrons of Spanish Charlie's at bay by slashing back and forth with a large, heavy-bladed hatchet. Conrad wasn't surprised when he saw the man's yellow-hued skin, dark, almond-shaped eyes, and the black hair braided into a pigtail that hung down his back between his shoulders. The man also had a peculiar scar shaped like a half moon on his right cheek. The hatchet men of Chinatown were famous, or notorious was probably a better word to describe them, but Conrad didn't know any reason why one of them would be helping him. He wasn't going to turn down the aid. As he struggled to his feet, he spotted a man with an old cap and ball revolver on the balcony drawing a bead on the big Chinese. Conrad's hand flashed to his Colt, still behind his belt at the small of his back. Sweeping his coattails aside, he brought up the revolver. The man dropped the gun and clutched at his wounded arm. Conrad put his back against that of his unexpected ally and swept the gun around.
I'm not a spy and I'm not a policeman, but I'm leaving here and nobody better try to stop me.
Your life! You're up to no good!
Back off and I'll never set foot in this place again! I promise you that!
Gradually, the crowd parted. Conrad kept a close eye on them as he edged toward the door with the Chinese man beside him. Evidently, anyone who had the impulse to pull a gun thought better of it, having seen what had happened to the man on the balcony. Conrad and his companion reached the door. They couldn't go through it together. The Chinese man jerked his head toward the door, indicating Conrad should go first. He didn't argue and ducked outside. No sooner had his boots hit the street, the Chinese man emerged from the saloon and stood next to him. Conrad grabbed the sleeve of the black jacket the man wore and tugged on it.
Let's get out of here!
After putting several blocks behind them, the two men slowed. Conrad heard shrill whistles in the distance and knew the police were converging on the saloon in response to reports of the gunfire. They would be too late, as usual. The ruckus was over. Conrad looked at his companion.
Thank you. I wouldn't have lasted much longer back there without your help. What's your name? Did you just happen to come along and see what was going on?
He didn't believe that for a second, but he wasn't aware of any other explanation. The Chinese man didn't say anything. He looked at Conrad with narrowed eyes for a second, then turned and loped away into the night.
Hey! Wait!
In a matter of moments, the man disappeared into the shadows, just like he had shown up, suddenly and mysteriously. Conrad shook his head. He had no explanation for what had just happened, but he knew he'd been lucky to get out of Spanish Charlie's alive. Now that he'd been given another chance, he intended to make good use of it as he continued his search for his children. He had what might be his best clue so far. One of the men who had taken part in the attempt on his life had a connection to the Golden Gate, a saloon or gambling den on Grant Street. Should he turn over that information to Claudius Turnbuckle and see what the lawyer's hired detectives could find out about it? Or should he continue his own investigation and pay a visit to the Golden Gate himself? He knew which way he was leaning, but he had done enough for one night. He still had to find a way to sneak back into the Palace Hotel without Morelli spotting him. That proved to be easier than Conrad expected. He used a tradesman's entrance in the rear to get into the hotel, then climbed the stairs to the fifth floor, where a stealthy look around the corner revealed that Morelli was sitting back in his chair with his hat tipped forward over his eyes. Conrad crept past him silently, unlocked the door of his suite, and let himself in. Conrad had lost the stevedore's cap during the fight at Spanish Charlie's. Stepping into the bedroom, he grabbed a long, thick robe and wrapped it around himself as he strode back to the door and jerked it open. He surprised Morelli in the act of raising a hand to rap on the door.
Mr. Browning, I thought I heard, is something wrong?
Only you sleeping on the job. My God, man. I could hear you snoring while I was all the way in the bedroom.
I'm sorry, Mr. Browning. It won't happen again, I swear. I won't close my eyes the rest of the night. You can see your way clear not to say anything to Mr. Turnbuckle about this, can't you?
All right. But stay alert, Morelli. I don't know if you've heard or not, but somebody wants me dead.
Yes, sir. I know. But they'll not get past me, sir. You've got my solemn oath on that.
Conrad closed the door. His ribs ached from that bear hug Ulrich had put on him. But the palace, haven of luxury that it was, had hot running water available in all its suites. So Conrad drew a bath, stripped off the workingman's clothes, and sank down in a massive claw-footed porcelain tub to soak away those aches. He made sure his Colt was fully loaded and lying on a chair within easy reach of the bathtub, and alongside the gun he had placed the carved ivory token from the Golden Gate. After soaking for a while, he reached over to the chair, picked up the token, and studied it, idly turning it over in his fingers. Tomorrow, he would find out more about the place where it came from. If someone connected with the Golden Gate had the initials DL, he would know he was still on the right trail. And if not, well, he would keep looking. Nothing was going to stop him from finding and claiming his children. This was the end game, and Pamela wasn't going to win. The red-headed, mustachioed Dugan was on bodyguard duty again the next morning when Conrad opened the door to Claudius Turnbuckle's knock. Conrad nodded and smiled at Dugan and ushered Turnbuckle into the suite.
Coffee?
Don't mind if I do.
Conrad had been eating breakfast, which had been delivered to the suite by a waiter from the hotel dining room. He had also been reading that morning's issue of the San Francisco Chronicle, which had been brought up with the food and coffee. Tucked away in the paper's rear pages was a small story about a brawl at a saloon in the notorious area known as the Barbary Coast, resulting in the death of two men, one from a gunshot wound, and the other from injuries inflicted with a hatchet, which had been found still lodged in the victim's body. The presence of the hatchet led the author of the story to speculate that perhaps one of the tongs from nearby Chinatown had been involved in the violence. The same possibility had occurred to Conrad once he had time to think over the events of the evening. The criminal societies, known as tongs, had ruled San Francisco's Chinatown for more than four decades, ever since the Chinese began to arrive in the gold rush days along with everyone else. The rulers of the tongs used assassins known as hatchet men to maintain their iron grip on the neighborhood and also to battle each other in bloody wars over who controlled what in Chinatown. The big man in black who had come to Conrad's aid certainly fit the description of a hatchet man. But for the life of him, Conrad couldn't see why such an individual would invade a round-eyes saloon to rescue him. He had no connection with the tongs whatsoever. Conrad poured coffee for Turnbuckle, who put his hat and overcoat on a side table and took the steaming cup gratefully.
Anything to report?
Conrad sat down at the table again.
No, I'm afraid not. Perhaps by the end of the day. Until we know something, my men will continue to investigate. Any problems here last night?
How could there be? With your man Morelli on duty and in the finest hotel in San Francisco to boot.
Nothing about this affair surprises me anymore.
Conrad smiled to himself. He suspected if Turnbuckle knew everything that had happened the previous night, he would be surprised, all right.
What are you going to do today?
Conrad picked up the folded newspaper.
Thought I might go down to the Chronicle offices.
Why?
Newspapermen are famous for knowing what's going on. I want to talk to a journalist I know who works there.
Oh, no offense, Conrad, but that's a bad idea. You wanted to keep this matter quiet, if possible. That's why we haven't brought the police in on it. Talking to a reporter is like asking to have your personal affairs shouted from the rooftops.
You're probably right in most cases, but I believe the man I'm thinking of will respect my wishes if I ask him for privacy.
Never trust a newspaper man. That's my motto.
Some people say the same thing about lawyers.
Yes, that's true. And, of course, you should do whatever you think is best. I've given you my advice. That's my job.
And you're excellent at it.
If you go out, at least take Dugan with you.
I don't think the estimable Mr. Dugan would have it otherwise.
Turnbuckle finished his coffee and left. Conrad dressed in his black suit and flat-crowned black Stetson. When he stepped out of the suite, Dugan stood up immediately from the armchair.
Going somewhere, Mr. Browning?
I am, and you're coming with me. Do you know how to get to the offices of the San Francisco Chronicle?
I sure do. You need to put an advertisement or a notice in the paper?
Something like that.
They left the hotel and walked several blocks to the impressive red brick building that housed the offices of the Chronicle. A woman at the counter in the lobby directed Conrad and Dugan to the third floor, where they found a large open area littered with desks where men sat pecking at typewriters. Conrad spotted the slender, balding man he was looking for and walked over to that desk, trailed by Dugan. The reporter glanced up as they approached, then looked again with eyes grown wide with surprise.
Conrad Browning.
He came to his feet.
I heard rumors you were in town, but I hadn't been able to confirm them yet.
Hello, Jessup.
Conrad shook hands with the man. Despite the lack of hair on the reporter's head, he was about Conrad's age. In fact, they had been in college together for a while, before Jessup Nash had decided he had no interest in running the textile mills his family owned and had disappointed them severely by going into journalism.
Jessup, this is Patrick Dugan. Dugan, meet Jessup Nash.
Dugan's hairy paw all but swallowed Nash's smaller hand.
I've seen the name in the paper. Never thought I'd be meeting the fella it belongs to.
It's a pleasure, Mr. Dugan.
Nash turned back to Conrad.
What brings you to San Francisco? Business or pleasure?
For some people, it's the same thing.
Yes, I remember when it was like that for you. But from everything that I've heard ever since... Damn it, Conrad. I was so glad to see you that for a minute I forgot. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm so sorry for your loss. I couldn't believe it when I heard about your wife. And everybody said that you were...
I know what you mean. And I appreciate the sentiments, Jessup. But sympathy's not why I'm here. I'm looking for information.
No, of course.
Nash pulled a chair from an empty desk over beside his desk.
Why don't you sit down?
You want me to stay, Mr. Browning?
I think it would be all right for you to go down to the lobby where you'll be comfortable. I'm confident no one will try to assassinate me here in the Chronicle's editorial offices.
Sounds good, but I'm supposed to keep my eye on you.
I'm not going anywhere. I'll come get you when I'm ready to leave.
If you're trying to trick me, you know I'll lose my job over this.
I wouldn't do that to those four red-headed little ones of yours.
I'll hold you to that.
Dugan walked back to the stairs and disappeared down them. Conrad and Nash sat down at the desk.
Your friend Mr. Dugan has the appearance of someone who's been hired to look after you. By Claudius Turnbuckle, say?
Jessup, before I tell you anything, or ask you anything... I have a request.
You don't want me to print anything that we're about to discuss.
That's right.
Well, that's a very difficult thing for a journalist to promise, Conrad. Our business is finding things to print.
I know that. And I can give you a good story. Maybe a better story than you've ever had. But only when the time is right.
You'll promise me an exclusive in return for my discretion and cooperation now?
Exactly.
Now, normally I wouldn't agree to such a thing. But since we're old friends... And since I have a hunch you're right about it being quite a story, I'll take a chance. What is it you want to know?
I have your word you won't write anything about this until I tell you it's all right.
My word.
What can you tell me about a place in the Barbary Coast called the Golden Gate?
The Golden Gate what? Walk around this city and you'll find everything from the Golden Gate Saloon to the Golden Gate Laundry. You mentioned the Barbary Coast, which leads me to think you're more likely talking about the saloon.
There is such a place.
Oh, yeah. One of the biggest drinking and gambling establishments in the area. Other things go on there as well, if you get my drift.
Conrad reached in his pocket and took out the ivory token.
Is this from there?
Sure. How did you get hold of one?
Never mind that now. What's its purpose?
Well, twofold, actually. All the people who work at the Golden Gate carry them. And the owner also hands them out to certain customers so they can gain entrance to the second floor, where the real drinking and gambling and those other things I mentioned go on.
The owner.
That's right. If you have one of those tokens, you must know him. His name's Dex Lanigan.
Dex Lanigan. Conrad had found D.L.
Dex Lanigan, eh?
Are you telling me you don't know him?
That's right.
Then how did you get that token?
That's part of the story I promised you when the time is right. What can you tell me about Lanigan?
He owns a successful saloon on Grant Street, smack dab between the Barbary Coast and Chinatown. That ought to tell you everything you need to know about the man. Despite a veneer of smoothness, Dex Lanigan is no more honest than he has to be. He's shrewd, ruthless, and dangerous. I suspect some of his competitors found that out to their regret, before their bodies were dumped in the bay, out to sea, that is.
So you think he's a killer?
I don't know if he's ever killed anyone personally, although it wouldn't surprise me if he had. But I'm confident he's ordered plenty of executions. So are the police. But they haven't been able to prove it.
How long has he been around?
That's an interesting question. He bought the Golden Gate about 3 years ago. Old Cletus Snyder owned it before that, but Schneider was in bad health and wanted out of the game. Lanigan came out of nowhere and took over the place. Some of us looked into his background afterward and found he'd been involved with some of the gangs along the Barbary Coast, but only as a low-level hoodlum. There was nothing in his history to indicate he had the money to buy a place like the Golden Gate or the skill to run it. Obviously, he had both, since he's made it more successful than it already was. Some important people in San Francisco have been known to patronize the private rooms of the Golden Gate. I suspect Lanigan has a pretty good blackmail racket going on.
Conrad nodded. He was intensely interested in everything Nash had said so far. The timing of Dex Lanigan's rise to power was very suspicious. Pamela had arrived in San Francisco about 3 years ago, Conrad thought. If she had somehow made contact with Lanigan, she could have bankrolled his purchase of the Golden Gate Saloon. She wouldn't have done that without getting something in return, though, such as his promise to send killers after Pamela's former fiancé if Conrad showed up in the city by the bay looking for his missing children. It was also possible Pamela had enlisted Lanigan's help in finding a place to hide the twins. Conrad knew he was going to have a face-to-face talk with Mr. Dex Lanigan, and soon.
What else can you tell me about
him? There's not much else to tell. His wife's a bit of a social climber. He's managed to get them invited to some parties where a cheap sharper like him has no business being. That's another reason I think he indulges in a little blackmail. Sometimes instead of money, he demands at least an illusion of respectability for himself and his wife.
You don't know if Lanigan's going to be attending one of those society parties anytime soon, do you?
Not my department, but I know how we can find out. Come on.
They stood, and Nash led him out of the big editorial room and into a corridor lined with smaller offices.
Where are we going?
To see Frances Carlyle. I'm sure you remember her.
As a matter of fact, he did. Frances Carlyle wrote a popular column for the Chronicle about the doings of San Francisco's high society. Not many women were involved in journalism, but Mrs. Carlyle, a widow, held an important and respected position among the city's elite. Conrad had met her on several occasions when he'd accompanied his mother to San Francisco, before Vivian Browning's vicious murder at the hands of an outlaw gang, a murder which had later been avenged by Frank Morgan. Conrad didn't like to think about those days. Some of those same outlaws had kidnapped and tortured him, mutilating one of his ears before Frank was able to rescue him. He kept his hair long enough to hide that deformity. If he had found himself in such a situation now, he would have figured out a way to kill those varmints himself, rather than relying on Frank to save him. He had changed a great deal since then. Mrs. Carlyle, a still attractive woman in her late 40s, with dark, curly hair only lightly touched with gray, stood up behind her desk.
Well, for heaven's sake, if it's not Conrad Browning himself.
She came around the desk and extended a hand.
Conrad, my dear boy, how are you?
Conrad took her hand and bent to brush his lips across the back of it in the courtly European manner. He recalled that while Mrs. Carlyle was quick to use her column to cut through what she regarded as pretense and hypocrisy, she enjoyed being played up to. He held her hand in both of his as he straightened.
I'm fine, Mrs. Carlyle. You haven't changed a bit. As beautiful as ever.
My deepest condolences on your loss.
Thank you.
I was very happy when I heard you were alive after all. That blasted Claudius Turnbuckle was tight-lipped about it for a long time.
At my request.
Yes. Well, I'm accustomed to people talking to me. I maintain a position of absolute trustworthiness.
Mrs. Carlyle could be trusted, all right. Trusted to gossip, which, of course, was exactly why Conrad was in her office. He understood why Jessup Nash had taken him there.
Sit down and tell me what brings you to San Francisco.
Mrs. Carlyle waved a hand at Nash.
Thank you for bringing Conrad to see me, Jessup. You can go now.
Nash looked pained, but didn't argue.
Stop by my desk on your way out, Conrad.
After Nash left, Conrad settled on the opposite side of the desk.
I'm relying on your absolute discretion here, Mrs. Carlyle.
Oh, my goodness, call me Francis. It's not like you're a callow youth anymore. You're a grown man.
All right, Francis. I want to ask you about a man named Dex Lanigan.
Dex Lanigan? Why are you interested in a cheap hoodlum like that?
From what I hear, he's not all that cheap. He owns a very successful business.
A saloon. And a saloon in the Barbary Coast at that.
And he's become a member of San Francisco society.
More of a pretender than a member. But for reasons I can't fathom, he's been issued invitations to a number of soirees the likes of him and that crass woman he's married to never should have attended. I think she must be the one behind it. She has that desperate hunger for approval you find in women who come from a less than sterling background.
Do you know if Lanigan is going to be attending any of those parties in the near future?
Why do you ask? Oh, don't tell me you want to meet the man.
It might be mutually beneficial for the two of us to have a conversation.
It might be easier to do while they were on neutral ground, Conrad thought, rather than him trying to approach Lanigan at the Golden Gate. If Lanigan wanted to keep his wife's position in society secure, he wouldn't cause a scene at a party.
You intrigue me. Something's going on here, and I want to know what it is.
I'm sorry. I can't tell you any more. Right now.
Quid pro quo? I know you studied Latin. You're familiar with the concept?
Of course. But my hands are tied at the moment. However, I can tell you this much. If my conversation with Lanigan goes as I hope, I can promise you there will be a story, and a good one.
And that story will be mine?
Conrad shrugged and inclined his head, indicating agreement without actually saying as much.
You're trying to trick me, young man. It won't work. I'm on to all the tricks young men use to make poor women like myself believe they've promised something when they really haven't.
She picked up a copy of the newspaper lying on the desk and tossed it closer to Conrad.
I won't haggle with you. Especially since what you want to know is already in print. And you'd already know it if you had bothered to read my column this morning.
Conrad picked up the paper, which was that morning's edition, folded back to Mrs. Carlisle's column. He had scanned those pages that very morning while eating breakfast, but he hadn't noticed what seemed so obvious to him now. One of the notes in the column was about a party to be held in 4 days at the Nob Hill mansion of Mr. and Mrs. Madison Kimball. Among a long list of guests expected to attend were Mr. and Mrs. Dexter Lanigan. The name had meant nothing to Conrad when he read it in the paper that morning, but he should have noticed the DL initials, he told himself. It hadn't occurred to him the man responsible for trying to have him killed would be attending a high society ball. He looked up at her.
Do you think you can arrange for me to be invited to that party?
I don't think it'll be any trouble at all. If Roberta Kimball knew you were in town, you would have already gotten an invitation, even if she had to deliver it personally. I'll mention that I've seen you, and you should hear from her before the day is over. Where are you staying?
At the palace.
Of course you are. I'll tell Roberta.
Thank you.
Conrad put the newspaper back on Mrs. Carlisle's desk.
Oh, a simple thank you isn't going to be enough. Not by a long shot.
Then what can I do to repay you for your help?
Let me share the story with that little reporter Nash when the time comes. And have dinner with me.
Conrad had a hunch Francis Carlisle's plans for him included more than dinner, but he would deal with that when the time came. As for sharing the story with Jessup Nash, he was confident he could make some sort of arrangement.
I think that's fair enough. Thank you for your help.
Mrs. Carlisle came around the desk and laid a hand on his arm.
Don't forget, we have a deal.
I won't.
If there's anything else I can do for you while you're in town, don't hesitate to let me know.
Conrad leaned closer and kissed her on the cheek.
Of course.
She was smiling when he left the office. As he eased the door closed, his thoughts immediately turned back to Dex Lanigan. Waiting 4 days to confront the man would be difficult, but that seemed like the best course of action. He would just have to be patient, Conrad told himself. He had waited this long to find his children. A few more days wouldn't hurt anything.
Did you find out what you wanted to know?
Conrad stopped at his desk.
I hope so.
The old witch didn't make you promise your firstborn in return for her help?
Conrad managed not to wince. Nash didn't know anything about the reason he was in San Francisco, he reminded himself. The reporter didn't mean anything by the comment about Conrad's firstborn.
We reached an equitable arrangement, and I'd hardly call Frances Carlisle an old witch.
I'm probably being unfair to her, but watch yourself when you're dealing with her, Conrad. She'll steal a story right out from under you if you're not careful.
But I'm not a reporter.
She can be a little predatory when it comes to young men she finds attractive. At least, so I've heard. I don't seem to be her type, thank God.
I'll be in touch.
When he reached the lobby, he spotted Patrick Dugan sitting in a chair next to a potted palm. Dugan was reading a newspaper, or at least pretending to. His gaze roved around the lobby constantly as he kept a lookout for trouble, the way a good bodyguard should. He spotted Conrad and stood up, leaving the paper in the chair.
Get your business taken care of?
Yes. We're going back to the hotel now.
Conrad wasn't sure how he was going to fill up the time during the next 4 days as he waited for the ball at the Kimball Mansion. Maybe he could actually force himself to rest and relax, as Claudius Turnbuckle had suggested. Although, if he was being honest with himself, he considered that possibility rather remote. After everything that had happened, he didn't think he was capable of going back to a life of leisure. A thought occurred to him as he and Dugan walked back toward the palace.
Were you ever a policeman, Patrick?
Oh, because I'm a big red-headed Irishman, you mean?
Because you seem to know what you're doing.
Oh, well, in that case, yeah. I was on the force for 10 years. Did right well for myself, too. Worked my way up to being a detective. But then Mr. Turnbuckle offered me more money to work for him, and, well, I had hungry mouths to feed. I couldn't turn down the job.
What do you do for Claudius besides bodyguard work?
Well, whatever needs doing. I've handled quite a few investigations for him, working on one case or another.
When you were with the police, did you ever have anything to do with the Tongs?
What do you mean? Are you asking if any of those heathen Chinamen ever paid me off to look the other way while they went about their mischief?
Good Lord, no. I just wondered if you handled any cases involving them.
Oh, sorry. I reckon I jumped to a conclusion there. Yeah, some of the cases I worked on took me to Chinatown. You can't turn around in Chinatown without bumping into somebody from one of the Tongs.
Are they still at war with each other?
Well, there's still some trouble now and then. But it's not like it used to be. Diamond Jack took care of that.
Diamond Jack?
Yeah. His real name is Wong Duck, but he calls himself Diamond Jack because he's got a little diamond mounted right there.
Dugan tapped a blunt fingertip against one of his two front teeth.
He came up through the Wu Sing Tong and finally took it over. That wasn't enough for him, though. He managed to talk the other Tongs into calling a truce. He said they could all make more money if they weren't fighting each other all the time. That makes sense, of course, but I didn't figure he'd ever talk all those other Chinamen into going along with the idea. So somehow he did.
So they don't have hatchet men anymore?
Oh, the Tongs still have their hatchet men, all right. The leaders don't trust each other all that much, and I reckon none of them completely trust Diamond Jack. Why are you asking about Tongs and hatchet men and such like?
I saw a big fellow on the street the other day. He was Chinese, dressed all in black, with a half-moon-shaped scar on his right cheek.
Conrad traced a finger along his own cheek to indicate the path of the scar.
When I saw him, I said to myself, now that looks like a hatchet man. So the sight made me curious, that's all.
Sounds like a hatchet man, all right. Most of them are big, ugly scoundrels. You want to stay away from them, Mr. Browning, and you should steer clear of Chinatown, too. There's nothing down there but joss houses, opium dens, brothels, and eating joints where they serve things you're better off not knowing what they are. No reason for a white man to have anything to do with that place.
I'm not going there. I was curious, that's all.
Yeah, you just listen to old Pat Dugan, sir. I won't steer you wrong.
I'm sure you won't.
At the same time, he wondered about the man who had saved his life in Spanish Charlie's. Dex Lanigan's Golden Gate Saloon was on the boundary between Barbary Coast and Chinatown. Was it possible there was a connection between the Tongs and his mission to find his children? Would Pamela have hidden the twins somewhere in the depths of the Chinese Quarter? Conrad didn't want to think so, but at the same time, was anything beyond the realm of possibility when it came to Pamela Tarleton? Despite what he had told Dugan, he might have to pay a visit to Chinatown after all. The rest of the day passed quietly, and that evening Conrad was sitting in his suite after supper when someone knocked on the door. Morelli was on duty in the corridor again, and Conrad knew that after being caught sleeping the night before, the bodyguard was unlikely to let anybody into the suite who wasn't harmless. Conrad opened the door and found a man in a sober black suit standing there, bowler hat in hand.
Mr. Conrad Browning?
Morelli stood a few feet away, watching with his arms crossed and a suspicious frown on his face.
That's right.
The man extended a square envelope with a fancy seal pressed into the wax, holding it closed.
With the compliments of the Mr. and the Mrs. Madison Kimball, sir.
Mrs. Carlyle had kept her promise, Conrad thought, as he took the envelope and broke the seal. Sure enough, a fancy gold-printed invitation to the ball at the Kimball Mansion was inside on a heavy, gilt-edged card. Conrad knew the man in the black suit, probably the Kimball's butler, was waiting for a response to take back to his employers.
Please tell Mr. and Mrs. Kimball I'll be honored to attend.
Thank you, sir. I certainly shall. Good evening.
When the butler was gone, Morelli walked up next to Conrad.
Going somewhere, sir?
Not tonight, but 4 nights from now I'll be attending a party at the Kimball Mansion.
I've heard of the place. Never been there. Mr. Turnbuckle's going to want me to come along with you, and I ain't sure they'll let me in.
If they think you're my driver, they'll let you wait outside with the other drivers.
I don't know if that'll be good enough to suit Mr. Turnbuckle.
I'll speak to him. I'm sure we can work something out. You'll be close by, even if you aren't in the mansion itself.
Sometimes close is still too far away.
Conrad knew the truth of that, perhaps better than anyone. He had been close enough to see Rebel in Black Rock Canyon, just not close enough to save her from being killed. He forced that thought out of his head and closed the door. Tossing the invitation onto a side table, he went back to the chair where he'd been sitting. A newspaper and a copy of Harper's Weekly were on the table next to the chair. He had already been having trouble concentrating as he tried to read, and now that he knew he was going to the Kimball's ball, he was even more distracted. He began thinking about how he would approach Dex Lanigan. If Lanigan was behind the attempts on his life, the man probably knew what he looked like and would recognize him. It was highly unlikely Lanigan would pull a gun and start blazing away at him in the middle of the party, but Conrad couldn't rule out the possibility entirely. He needed a smaller gun, something he could carry without anyone noticing it. Tomorrow, he would look for such a weapon, he decided. Something small, but with stopping power at short range. If there was a gunfight at the Kimball's ball, all of San Francisco society would be scandalized. But Conrad didn't care about that. If there was a gunfight, he intended to win. Accompanied by Patrick Dugan, Conrad visited a gunsmith's shop the next day and picked out a Smith & Wesson 38 caliber double-action revolver with a five-shot cylinder and a barrel that wasn't much more than 2 inches long.
The barrel was 3 1/4 inches starting out, but I took some off that to make it easier to carry in the inside pocket of a coat or in a shoulder holster. You can get a smaller gun, Mr. Browning, but the 38 will put a man down where a 32 won't always.
Conrad nodded as he checked the heft and balance of the weapon and liked what he felt.
With such a short barrel, you can't expect much accuracy, can you?
Only at close range, but that's where you're most likely to need a gun such as this, isn't it?
Conrad couldn't argue with that. He bought the gun and a shoulder holster the gunsmith was only too happy to sell him. Conrad had told Dugan about attending the ball at the Kimball Mansion. He figured Morelli had already reported to Turnbuckle about the butler delivering the invitation the night before, so there was no point in trying to keep it a secret. They walked back to the hotel with Conrad carrying the case containing the revolver and the holster.
You bought that gun to wear to the party, didn't you, sir?
With everything that's happened, I think it's probably a good idea to be armed at all times, even though I have a fine bodyguard with me.
Considering what I know about you, Mr. Browning, I reckon if trouble broke out, it'd be more likely for you to save my life than the other way around.
Let's just try to avoid trouble.
Yeah, but be ready for it if it comes.
Always.
Time dragged by. Jessup Nash paid a visit to Conrad's suite at the Palace Hotel the next day, clearly hoping he would get his old friend to reveal more details about that big story he'd been promised, but Conrad remained tight-lipped. He did the same when Frances Carlyle called on him later the same day. She made it fairly obvious she would be willing to spend some time with him in his bedroom, whether he told her any more about the story or not, but he eased her out of the suite discreetly and without hurting her feelings.